sita. Let us move forward. Madan Alakirelovunga, your Inuk host on Words and Culture to talk about our Inuit language, Inuktitut. Please join me as we move forward, Kayustiluta, to another great interview in the next episode, because our people are doing amazing things for our languages. Atsunai!
Words and Culture is made possible with funding from SiriusXM through the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Words and Culture is produced by Kim Wheeler. Kaylin Belair is our audio engineer and editor.
Onigiwahi.
Gigawabamin. Soko seni denit e. Nina nyuji hina.
Eko se.
Kakuhutau. We'll see you again.
Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. My name is Borshus, and I'll be with you for the next half hour on today's show. Tenants in Quebec voiced frustrations over Quebec's housing tribunal, saying it's nothing more than an eviction machine.
The main activity of the Tribunal Administratif du Logement is to evict tenants. They use the procedures as a threat over their tenants.
Ian Sutherland is Mount Allison's 16th resident. His new strategic plan will address challenges in funding and reduced student visa quotas.
There has been a decline in investment in higher education nationally, globally. So we need to look at what are other ways that we can bring in additional revenues to the university.
At the other end of the country, climate change researcher Tristan Pierce has been reappointed as Tier 2 Canada Research Chair.
So it just makes sense that if we're interested in what we could potentially face ourselves here in Prince George or elsewhere, you look north, you get the lessons learned.
Newfoundland's award-winning songwriter Dave McHugh passed away on November 8. He was just 57 years old. The whole community was shaken up by his passing.
And I'll always miss him. I'm still waiting for him to come in at 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning, but he's not showing up.
And to Ontario, where abandoned dogs get a second chance at a better life at the Snowflakes Shelter in Haliburton County. Welcome to Viewpoints Local News Nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Thanks so much for being with us again this week as we take you to BC, Ontario, New Brunswick, Newfoundland, and Quebec. And Montreal will be our first stop this week, where tenant associations are pushing for reforms at Quebec's housing tribunal, the Tribunal Administratif du Logement. Tenant groups came out from all across the province of Quebec on Wednesday to call attention to what they describe as a systemic bias towards landlords. Cédric Dussault of the RCLALQ, a province-wide tenants' rights group, told reporters on Monday that tenants need better access to information and justice. The CORPIC, which represents landlords in the province, said they also want a tribunal that is clearer and more accessible to all. But for Verdun tenant organizer Lynn O'Donnell, it will take major reforms to fix a system she calls an eviction machine. Jules Bigiel in Montreal, Quebec.
Tenants came out across Quebec last week to push for change at the Tribunal Administratif du Logement. Also known as the TAL, it's Quebec's housing tribunal, the body that settles disputes between landlords and tenants. But tenants' rights workers say the scales are weighted in landlords' favor, leaving renters discouraged by the process.
There's a huge lack of access to justice for tenants. They barely have access to lawyers. And these landlords have tons of money, tons of access to justice. It's not equal.
This is Lynn O'Donnell, an organizer at Verdun's Housing Committee, the CACV. At a rally on Wednesday outside the TAL's Montreal office, she told CKUT that the tribunal's priorities can be seen in whose cases it puts first.
This tribunal, under this system, I mean, I don't know if it could ever be perfect, that's for sure, but like as it stands right now, it is literally just an eviction machine that runs super slowly.
Cédric Dussault, spokesperson for the tenants' rights advocacy group, the RECLAC, made a similar case at a press conference last Monday.
The main activity of the Tribunal Administratif du Logement is to evict tenants. We have a delay of 1.7 months for non-payment. This is over urgent matters that are affecting tenants. For urgent matters, it's 1.9 months, and we're talking about very urgent matters where You have people who are threatened, that their health or their security is threatened. And for other cases, it's about 6 months or even more.
The data here comes from the TAL's annual report. A spokesperson told CKUT in a statement that their target for non-payment and urgent situations are the same, and that if a tenant gives documented evidence demonstrating a risk to health or safety, their case is heard within 10 days. But the RCLAC says that tenants often don't even know this and other rights that they have because of steep delays in accessing information.
Since the pandemic, the TAL has never returned to give a service in person unless you have an appointment. And to have an appointment is difficult in itself. First, because if you go online, you try to have an appointment in most offices of the Tribunal Administratif du Logement, it's more than 1 month to have an appointment. And for people who have problems going online and who do not necessarily have a good understanding of those procedures, when they try to phone the Tribunal Administratif du Logement, the Tribunal does not answer.
It isn't just the RCLAC saying this. The Quebec Ombudsman has come out and said they're pushing for change at the TAL as well. The TAL says that workers are only able to answer 8% of around 1 million calls they receive in a year. And they say that figure has only gotten worse, taking almost 20% fewer calls than the year before, as the public's needs have grown more complex. Here's Tribunal Chair Patrick Simard speaking to members of the National Assembly in October.
Collectivement, sommes-nous satisfaits des résultats obtenus malgré les efforts déployés? Il est impossible de l'être. Alors que l'organisme n'arrive qu'à répondre à peu près 8% des 1,2 million d'appels qu'il reçoit.
Dussault says it's a symptom of a larger problem. When tenants can't get information about their rights, he says it leaves the system open to abuse.
So you have right now a lot of landlords who are abusing the procedures at the Tribunal Administratif du Logement, and they are not interested in a conciliation. They use the procedures as a threat over their tenants.
A spokesperson for the CORPIC, which represents landlords in the province, told CKUT in a statement that, quote, "We see that both tenants and landlords are inconvenienced by the difficulties encountered by the TAL. We are pleading for the system to be clearer and more accessible to all." The TAL, meanwhile, say they're counting on the province's investment in last month's economic update to help. It gives an additional $6.2 million over 4 years. But with a public hiring freeze, only time will tell whether that money leads to more staff at the TAL. With CKUT, I'm Jules Bugel with the Local Journalism Initiative.
Hello, I'm Candace Vetter in Embrun, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints.
University of British Columbia climate change researcher Dr. Tristan Pierce has been reappointed as Tier 2 Canada Research Chair. Pierce, an associate professor at the University of British Columbia, will for the next 3 years lead research on the cumulative impacts of climate change and focus on the Arctic region through the Federal Tri-Council. The Council just received a $1.5 million grant for the next 3 years. Dr. Pierce is also leading an international study on climate change, food systems, and the health of Indigenous peoples across 13 different countries. This through the Indigenous Peoples Observatory Network. Pierce sees the Arctic region as an early warning system for changes in climate. He adds, if we're interested in what we could potentially face ourselves here in Prince George or elsewhere, you look north, you get the lessons learned, and then hopefully you can take some of those lessons and have an early opportunity to make some adjustments if needed. Here's part of his conversation with journalist Ian Craig in Prince George, BC.
You know, I take it really seriously when it comes to using other people's money to do something that hopefully will benefit not only them, but the people around them. Answer your question, how does this translate to affect people here? I think it comes down to that everybody is affected in some degree by what we're calling climate change. Everybody. And in this work, by working with people at the grassroots level, it might not be specifically in your own community or in your own city, but globally, it allows that kind of bottom-up information to come to the surface. It's talking to people who, meeting people where they live to understand the changes that affect them most and come up with solutions that are local.
To me, your area of research sounds so broad. I mean, it's spanning 13 countries. I imagine there's a lot of travel involved. Does it feel scattered in the moment, or how are you able to focus in on the individual aspects that you can then kind of draw out the bigger picture of what you're seeing and experiencing across this territory?
That's just it. It's asking the bigger picture. This is just one project amongst many, and it builds on all the others. So really, when it comes to what my expertise is, I'm trained as a geographer. Some people will ask, what the heck is a geographer? And really, a geographer is someone who studies people and place. And some people really are interested in the place, and they might understand the physical aspects of that place. And some people might be interested in more of the human aspects. I tend to focus more on the human questions and then bridge to the physical. So it's that human-environment relationship. And in this case, you know, one of my specializations is understanding how changes in the physical system translate to affect the lives, you know, the livelihoods of the people who depend on it. So we start talking about climate. Well, it affects anybody who relies on the environment, which is pretty much everybody.
Yeah, I can't think of too many exceptions.
Yeah, and the reason I am intrigued by the Arctic, when I'm speaking about the Arctic right now, you know, we look at Canada, we have 51 Inuit communities that span from the west to the east, coast to coast to coast, occupying these communities for land settlement agreements. It seems far, but it's actually close. And this is just one part of the larger circumpolar Arctic. The reason I find it intriguing is it's really the early warning system for changes in climate. It's where we're seeing it first. So it just makes sense that if we're interested in what we could potentially face ourselves here in Prince George or elsewhere, you look north, you get the lessons learned, and then hopefully you can take some of those lessons and have an early opportunity to make some adjustments if needed. And that goes to your question, which is, how do you draw these new lessons? Well, that's the best part of it is, you know, we're only can do so much as an individual, but when you start to link with other individuals who are also doing that effort in those places, building the relationships, well, then you can start to see those kind of cross-cutting themes, lessons shared, opportunities for collaboration. And that's where it gets really exciting and innovative as far as maybe generating some information that can be useful when it comes to talking about what do we do about some of these challenges with climate as it relates to water, as it relates to food, as it relates to security, migration, all the different challenges that we're already facing.
So Dr. Pierce is building relationships not only here in Prince George, not only in the Canadian Arctic, but within and throughout the IPON Research Network. Believe it or not, some of that research is actually quite local to our region in the central interior of British Columbia. Dr. Pierce, could you please touch a little bit on what you and your team are observing east of Prince George in the Robson Valley?
One of the things we're seeing locally with a trend in a change in climate is we're seeing changes in mountain snowpack. And most recently, with the years of the El Nino, we've seen a dramatic drop in snowpack. For some, they might just think that might affect maybe some recreational activities. But what we're learning is it has a lot deeper implications. One of them is water availability. So when we're dealing with the Robson Valley, we have communities that are almost exclusively dependent on snowpack for fresh water. So it's hard to really understand that until you live it, but imagine things that you use fresh water for. And that goes across the board from watering your veggie garden, or maybe you have more of a commercial scale agriculture. Your pets, your agricultural livestock, yourself, human consumption, bathing, drinking, everything. And what we're seeing here is that, you know, these communities have been dealing with drought over the last couple of years, and that trend is expected to continue. Will we have fluctuations? Absolutely. But there's a strong signal that we're going to experience more of these kind of extreme conditions, such as drought, as we move into the future.
Dr. Tristan Pierce, reappointed as a Tier 2 Canada Research Chair, is continuing his research into cumulative impacts of environmental change in global Arctic regions, in geographies of all kind across the globe, and close to home in the Robson Valley.
Thanks to Ian Gregg.
You're tuned to Viewpoints.
Let's head to the other end of the country and turn our attention to New Brunswick's Mount Allison University. It's not often that we get to sit down and chat with the president of a renowned institution and have a chance to get the lowdown on how universities think and work. Journalist Erica Butler had that opportunity as she conducted an extensive interview with Dr. Ian Sutherland, Mount Allison's 16th president. Ian Sutherland has been president and vice Vice-Chancellor of Mount Allison University since mid-July, but as last Friday, he's been officially installed in the position in a ceremony at Convocation Hall. The new president here talks about the university's upcoming strategic planning process and how declining international student quotas and public funding challenges are impacting the institution. Here's part of that conversation as he first talks about strategic planning.
Where do you see Mount A is going? What are your ideas and suggestions for Mount Allison's future? What do you think is the very best of what Mount Allison is today that we must maintain moving forward? Getting that collective wisdom from faculty, staff, students, alumni, the wider Mount Allison community through in-person consultations, virtual consultations, hybrid consultations, survey, questionnaire. We'll be doing a whole bunch of different modes for people to input. But the goal is the collective wisdom, ground up, iterative, consultative process to really chart the next 5 to 10 years of Mount Allison, where we're going. It will provide us broad direction where we want to go in terms of academic program development, in terms of service learning, in terms of community engagement, in terms of student growth and numbers and these kinds of things. The big broad issues, infrastructure renewal, that kind of thing. But we'll chart our direction for the next foreseeable future.
We've seen, for example, the federal government make moves to cut back on immigration quotas. Most pertinent to Mount A is international student visa numbers. That's something that all universities are facing, but what kind of impact do you think it is having and will have here at Mount A, and how will you grapple with it?
The federal government change in policy is an unfortunate one. Governments make decisions for a variety of reasons, and that those are their reasons. At the end of the day, I feel like it's an unfortunate one. International students at Mount Allison provide such a richness and diversity and tapestry of cultures, languages, ethnicities, backgrounds of all sorts, and that richness is integral to the fabric of Mount Allison, and indeed every university that has international students, which would be practically all of them, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's unfortunate in that respect, and I think that the announcements from the federal government have lessened Canada's stature in the world as a destination of first choice for international students. So I think those are the unfortunate elements of this. International students, in my experience across my full academic career, and it's certainly been proven true again here at Mount Allison, international students are amongst, if not the most engaged, the most present in student government, in committee work, and daily life on campus. They bring a vibrancy to the campus that is so wonderful and I think critical. So any diminishment of that is generally, in my mind, unfortunate and regrettable. Yes, we absolutely have to respond to that. And so what we will be doing in our response is ensuring that we are recruiting as many international students as we possibly can. And that means being very focused on the areas where we've got great presence already internationally to ensure those pipelines of students coming in are still strong, and those students understand that Mount Allison is a destination of absolutely first choice in the global landscape, not just the Canadian landscape. The federal government has now reduced international study permits by 45%. It's actually a little bit more than that for undergraduates, because graduate students are now included in that mix. We won't get into the math of it all, but we'll say it's at least 45%, which means that we will probably have 45%-ish fewer international students in a few years' time once this rolls through all 4 years of a degree program. There has been a decline in investment in higher education nationally, globally. So we need to look at what are other ways that we can bring in additional revenues to the university, things like conference services, the use of residences during the summertime, summer programming, etc. There are other ways that we can bring in revenues to the university to manage offsets to government. But we need to look at alternate revenue sources and also how we are spending the money that we have, right? So we also have a new provincial provincial government in New Brunswick. And I have great optimism and high hopes for our work with this government, that they understand the importance of education, the importance of higher education to the province and to the region, and the centrality of Mount Allison as Canada's number one undergraduate university in attracting great talent to this province, keeping great talent in this province, and also as an economic driver of this region in particular. So I've got great hopes of working well with the current, the new provincial government here as well.
That's President and Vice Chancellor of Mount Allison, Dr. Eason Sutherland. This interview has been edited for length, and you can hear the full version, including talk of Mount Allison's major capital project with the Ralph Pickard Bell Library, over at chmafm.com, along with some audio highlights from Dr. Sutherland's installation ceremony last Friday. This is Erica Butler, reporting for the Local Journalism Initiative.
The complete interview can be heard on frequencynews.ca. Well, dogs may be humans' best friend, but they're not disposable. That sentiment is what drives Kristen Begbie to rescue and care for stray and abandoned dogs in Haliburton County, Ontario. Snowflake Meadows, a rescue shelter located just outside of Loughlin, focuses on trying to give dogs a better life. The shelter recently took in 47 dogs in just 1 month. Elizabeth Oakley in Haliburton, Ontario, visited Snowflake Meadows and learned about the challenges and rewards of taking in unwanted animals in an environment where care comes first.
All of them are rescues. Everybody in here is a rescue. Everybody.
It's mid-morning at Snowflake Meadows, a dog rescue center just outside Loughlin in Haliburton County. The dogs are rambunctious, loud, and eager for attention. Kristen Begbie is den mother to these rescued dogs who've either been abandoned or surrendered to her. How they come to her isn't what's important, though. It's all about trying to give them a better life, a second chance. But with a recent surge, a whopping 47 dogs in 1 month alone, Snowflake Meadows is bursting at the seams.
47 dogs in 31 days looks like people calling and dropping off puppies left, right, and center. So we had a litter of 8 Kangles. These guys right here, they're 6 months old now. We had, was it 8 or 9 Border Collie puppies? Then we had a stray dog dropped off who had 6 puppies and 1 passed away, so there's 5. And then the boxers from Trapper's Trail, there was 7 of them.
Kristen says a combination of factors have led to the explosion of dogs arriving at shelters in recent months. According to a study by Rover, an estimated 41% of Canadians purchased dogs during the COVID pandemic. During COVID, many people working from home purchased dogs, but couldn't afford the prohibitive cost of spaying and neutering when faced with a rising cost of living in the region. As a result, many dogs had litters of puppies, and people couldn't afford to feed and care for them. Many people chose breeds which are unsuitable for families, who later developed behavioral issues. Countless dogs have been surrendered to shelters or simply abandoned. Kristen doesn't focus on blame, but instead puts all her attention on caring for the vulnerable dogs who've come to her.
Dogs are seen as a property. They are to people, they are disposable. And if people can't find help for them, Kyra, if people can't find help for them, then they are just dumping them because they don't have the money to feed them. They don't have the money to afford their veterinary care. I think about the animal more so than the person. I think about how it's not fair to them and what is going to make it their life better for them in order to just completely block out the stupidity of some people. Unfortunately, there's common sense is lacking. Absolutely, they deserve better. And that's, I always say, like, I'm the stepping stone into a positive future for them.
Kristen has been taking in dogs since 2018, and Snowflake Meadows became officially registered as a not-for-profit in 2020. Last year alone, 263 dogs were cared for and either fostered or rehomed at Snowflake Meadows. The rescue is funded entirely through donations covering the cost of food, bedding, and pens, but receives assistance from the Kibble Project and other groups who support dog shelters and rescue organizations. Snowflake Meadows has a strong team of dedicated volunteers, and Kristen is grateful to her team who put the dog's welfare above all else.
Everybody's just so upbeat and happy and just like super like Their energies just vibe with everything that's going on here. They want to help out. They're not judgmental. But everybody is just, they're just amazing. Whatever you need, Kristen, what do you need? What do you need in order for you to be able to keep doing something else to make this easier? It's awesome.
Kristen puts adoptive families through a regimented vetting process prior to releasing dogs into their care. She does so for the best outcome for the dog and the prospective owners.
I want to make sure that they're going to the right home. I love these dogs. I took them in and cared for them and got to know them so that I'm placing them in the right home so they don't end up out on the streets and they don't have to worry about being bounced around. They give so much love. That's all they know. And like even the ones that are afraid like and are fearful and show you their teeth, they really have a lot of love behind that, whatever that learned fear is from. And they don't have a voice. So I like to be able to speak for them.
The name Snowflake Meadows is in honor of Kristen's mother, who loves snowflakes and had a running bet when the first snowfall would be each year. Now, as both her parents have passed away, the center's name reflects both her love of her family and the individual uniqueness of every dog that comes into her care.
Snowflakes are significant. I'm going to start crying. They mean a lot to me. They do. And every dog is so unique, like a snowflake, that they're all my snowflakes.
Thanks to Elizabeth Oakley in Haliburton, Ontario. And we close this edition of Viewpoints on a sad note. Award-winning songwriter Dave McHugh passed away on November 8. He was just 57 years old. His career spanned over four decades. He was the founding member of the rock group Illusion, with whom he performed all over the country, just as he did later during his long solo career. More than a month after his death, people from the west coast of Newfoundland gathered at the Corner Brook Civic Center this past weekend for a celebration of his life and art. Tonya Organ in Cornerbrook, Newfoundland and Labrador.
It was probably Newfoundland Labrador's best living room at the celebration of Dave McHugh's Saturday at the Cornerbrook Civic Center. That's according to his brother, Brian McHugh. Dave passed away on November 8th, leaving a void for all who knew him. At Saturday's event, a large crowd showed their respects to Dave, with life-size posters of him on the walls and about 30 local musical entertainers. Brian McHugh says it was easy to feel his brother's presence.
We wanted to make sure that all of you had a chance to come together and to honor Dave and share in his love and friendship and talk about him. And that's where the healing really starts. We're all feeling this massive void. And it's just so good to bring Dave back in that way to be able to remember him.
May of Islands MHA Eddie Joyce presented Dave's mother, Anne McHugh, with the 75th anniversary of Newfoundland and Labrador Confederation with Canada Award and Medal. Mrs. McHugh graciously accepted and says she still waits for her Davy to come home.
I didn't prepare a speech or anything, but I'd just like to say thank you to everybody who showed up to show their affection for my precious Davy, and I called him Davy too because he was my baby, and he was a good baby. He treated me well, and I'll always miss him. I'm still waiting for him to come in at 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning, but he's not showing up. Anyway, thank you so much, everybody.
Cornerbrook MHA and Cabinet Minister Jerry Byrne was there to announce a $30,000 yearly scholarship is being created in Dave's name by the provincial government.
$30,000 has been placed with our province's Music Industry Association to establish an annual endowment, a scholarship, an honorarium that will bear Dave McHugh's values. His name will continue to be sung from this day forward. This annual endowment will be for the purposes of supporting artists and artistry while recognizing that in everyone's life's journey, we all need a helping hand sometimes, and we all need a friend like Dave McHugh.
Donations from the event are going to the Western Memorial Regional Hospital Foundation and the Prostate Cancer Survivors Network. I'm Tonya Organ, reporting for the Local Journalism Initiative.
And that is it for us this week. Thanks to our journalists, Tanya Oregon, Ian Gregg, Erica Butler, Jules Bigiel, and Elizabeth Oakley. Our national editors are Victoria Fenner and Conrad Fox. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and, of course, your local radio station. Remember to catch all our stories on frequencynews.ca. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Happy to have you with us again this week. And until the next, ciao.
In beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints.
If I had 2 dozen roses and an old bottle of wine, if I really could have hung the moon, would it change your mind?
Hello and welcome to another episode of Plugged in My Ears. I'm Adam, joined by Kyle, Sam, and James. It's a good day to talk about some sports. There's a lot of interesting things going on in the league. We've kind of been a little absent, I guess. I mean, we haven't really been as fully, maybe me specifically, hasn't been fully involved with the Plugged in My Ears the last few weeks, but...
Well, you know what they say, Adam, absence makes the heart grow fonder, and my heart is pounding for you right now.
You know, I was actually just researching really hard over the last few weeks, and I came and brought my A game today, so...
I'm delighted to hear that.
Yeah, I know you are.
What do you got for us then, research master?
So I think obviously it's the biggest news in the world right now, but Patrick Laine is on a heater.
he is on a heater.
3 goals in 4 games since he's come back from Montreal. That is my Montreal Canadiens news for the episode. I'm loving it. He's a power play. He makes that power play so much better.
Yeah, he
honestly makes everyone around him look better too. He's playing on a line with Slavkovsky and Doc. And those guys were having really rough starts this season, especially Kirby Doc. And Laine's been able to make him look somewhat competent out there on the ice. I mean, Doc is still, I think, minus 21 or 22 on the year. And he's like 10 minus worse than anyone else on Montreal. It's ridiculous. And Slavkovsky just hasn't been able to score. But I don't know. I think Laine makes the team a lot better. I mean, they beat my Stanley Cup favorite, Nashville Predators, and they're tied with the Anaheim Ducks right now. I think I'm actually going to retract that statement after they lost to Montreal, because there's no way Nashville is going to do anything. They got shut out by Montreal, and that's just not good. That's not Stanley Cup winning.
Well, I'm surprised you didn't mention something else out of Montreal. Montembeau got nominated to play on Canada's team. He's the third string goaltender.
He did make Team Canada.
We'll talk about that after, but you know, I don't know if you noticed this, Adam. Laine is on track to get a goal a game this season if he continues at this rate.
Yeah. I mean, I'll take it, right?
It's
kind
of crazy.
He said he wanted to come back a 50-goal scorer, not even a 40-goal scorer. And I don't know if he'll be able to do it this year, but if he goal per game pace, he could get 40.
He could.
Yeah.
No, it could happen. I mean, he's got to keep it up and not be bad.
And I mean, Caulfield is still up there. Caulfield, I think he scored his 17th of the year in the last game. Right. So Montreal's got some goal scoring, which has been like something I haven't had experienced in a long time as a Montreal fan. I think the last, like, I don't even know the last pure goal scorer that played for Montreal, probably Kovalev. But
oh my god, I forgot about Kovalev, man. Yeah. That guy was insane.
I mean, that was before my time, really. Like that, I wasn't really watching too much. I think he was mainly end of his career when I started to watch hockey. I don't think he was really.
Well, Kovalev came to Ottawa for a bit, and I played hockey with his son. And I was showing this video to James on the weekend of Kovalev, but he got my dad and Lucas Teslik. He goes to Queens with us, his dad as well, to film a video for him. And basically, it's just like him sniping Genos from every angle on the ice. I think the video starts, and he's just taking slap shots, getting them in top right corner consistently. There's like four in a row, and it's end-to-end slap shots. Then he goes to one-hand shots from the blue line, top right corner every time. He was pretty nasty. He was good. He was good. Yeah. His kid wasn't bad either. He had a gross toe drag, but just couldn't really communicate on the ice. Never knew where that guy was and understand. Pretty Bietz. But I was just making noises. But
are you ripping on Alexei Kovalev's kid right now?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Interesting.
Yeah. Is there some personal beef here?
No, his name is Ilya. He spoke better French than English.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
What didn't you like about him?
No, nothing. I just had a communication barrier because I didn't understand Russian.
Oh, but he spoke French, you said.
Yeah, but we didn't speak French to each other at hockey. He didn't do that.
Oh.
So that's what the cool kids did who were a year older.
Oh, I see.
We weren't a year older yet. We were still a minor novice.
He was older than you?
Yeah, he's a year older, so I only played with him every once in a while. But not often.
I wonder if he was named after Habs legend Ilya Kovalchuk.
Yeah, maybe. Probably not, but maybe. Maybe. But on a separate note, I mean, I think we got to talk about Jacob Trouba for a second here. James, I know you got a lot to say about this. You're a big Vinny Trocheck guy. I said Trocheck, wrong guy.
Yeah.
What do you think about that whole trade situation?
Yeah, I think Trouba had his time, you know, a little bit earlier in his career, but he'd kind of turned into a guy that was just throwing big hits and not really doing anything on the offensive end. And hilarious short video we were watching, and I have to agree with it. Just turned into an absolute liability out there. You know, the Rangers had a great squad, and he got 11 penalties in the playoffs, and he just wasn't doing much for the team. So personally, I got a little bit of soft spot for the Rangers, and I'm super happy he got traded to Anaheim. He didn't look happy, but at all, he looked super choked in the interview. But honestly, you know, I'm okay with that. Sorry, Trouba.
He's such a good painter. No, I'm joking. His paintings are not very good. I'm not really sure I understand them. Is someone actually buying those? I'm curious. I guess
paintings?
Someone is apparently, but I'm not sure who. But I guess there's a couple hanging in the arena somewhere.
There's a few guys who had some serious concussions that bought some paintings, from what I gather. But
I guess does he donate the money? I guess
I mean, maybe the painting is the donation.
I don't know. Yeah. Donation for who, but I'm not, yeah. But yeah, I guess the Ducks have got a new painter they've added, but they've also got Gudas and Trouba, so people are kind of worried about what's going to be coming up once they play the Ducks now.
I'm worried about the 30th best D pairing in the NHL.
I don't know if they're worried about scoring. I'm more worried about injuries.
Yeah, I think we're going to see a lot of big hits. It'll be kind of fun to see.
They're
going to
start creating new moves where they hit in the center. They collide like a sandwich and just crush the guy in the center.
There'll be Vatrano, Gudas, and Trouba. They'll all just sandwich them. It'll be absolutely ridiculous.
This will be good for future science classes to learn about Newton's second law. Every force has an equal and opposite force. But anyways, enough physics. Should that joke didn't really hit my brain. Well, let's talk about the Four Nations Cup. I mean, Canada's got a pretty cracked roster. First line is Sam Reinhart on the left wing with Connor McDavid in the middle, Nathan MacKinnon. That is crazy. That's like every little kid's dream to be on that line. What are your predictions, the four of you, or the three of you?
I don't think there's a chance against that power play, especially in the car on the back end. I don't know. That's a ridiculously stacked. What do you think? Do they have a power play lineup officially?
No, but I mean, let's try and predict it right now.
I think, well, obviously they're gonna put, I think they might put Sam Reinhart out there.
I think it's going to be that first line, Reinhart, McDavid with MacKinnon, and then I think Crosby and Makar are going to be on it too.
Yeah, that's pretty ridiculous. Power play.
I actually like, how do you max a power play more than that? I can't even.
I could see Braden Point getting on there too.
Yeah,
power play number one.
He might be PP2 because I feel like Braden Point's so good at breaking into the zone like he does for Tampa all the time, especially in their power play one. So that'll probably be Connor McDavid's role.
So I think you're right. He'll probably man the PP2. But no, I'm super excited. I agree. I think Canada definitely has the upper hand over everybody. Their goaltending is a little weak, but I'm a big fan of Aiden Hill. Shout out Vancouver Island. He's actually from Comox. So being an island boy myself, I got a soft spot for him. He's a sick goalie. It's going to be hard going up against Hellebuck as well as Ottinger and Swayman, though. Swayman hasn't been great, but obviously the goaltending on the U.S. is a lot better.
Yeah, it is. Oh, Adam, what do you have to say about that? I mean, your boy Sam Monty is on that team too, and we just talked about Canada's bad goaltending. He's the third string.
Hey, I mean, I completely agree. Monsonbeau is not the best goaltender in the world. He's a goaltender, but I think that definitely the U.S. has the edge when it comes to goaltending. Honestly, I think Canada's the worst goaltending out of all four teams. I think the States have a better roster than Canada. I don't love that John Cooper played favorites and added Brandon Hagel and was it Sorelli to the roster. Mm-hmm. I don't think that they're the best. They're even in the top 16 best Canadian forwards. No, maybe I'm a little salty that Nick Suzuki didn't get added onto the team.
I don't think he was really in the talk for that.
I think Suzuki will be one of the first ones they call if someone gets injured. Same with Caulfield. I feel like Caulfield not making the States is crazier than Suzuki not making Canada, as Caulfield is fourth in goals in the NHL right now. But, I mean, Montreal Canadiens bias again there. But I like the States roster. I think that they're deep. I think they're a little deeper than Canada. They may not have the star power, explosive power play, but from their forwards, defense, and goaltending, I think their forwards are second best in the tournament. Defense, arguably best, and arguably the best goaltending in the tournament. I think they're going to be the hardest team to beat. I like Sweden. I don't like Finland. I don't think that I think they're definitely the weakest team coming in, but I don't know. I don't have high hopes for Canada in this, as much as like everyone's talking about Canada having a great team, and I know they've got the star power, but only one person can be score on the goals, and I think they've got a lot of guys that want to be the guy that scored the goals. And I think that the States are going to spread it out a little bit better. I think that they know that Matthews is going to be that number one option on the first line. But I don't know. I think you got Jack Hughes, Jack Eichel, Jake Guentzel, Matt Boldy, Kyle Connor. That U.S. team is pretty stacked. I don't know how they're going to top it.
I'll take a little bit of a hard take on Matthews here. I think his playoff performance is depicted that he doesn't show up all the time in big moments. So even though he gets so many goals in the regular season, like Connor McDavid, one of the best playoff performers, McKinnon's an unbelievable playoff performer, like recent cups for McKinnon and Makar, as well as Sam Bennett, Sam Reinhart. So I think showing up in big moments is going to come in big for Canada. I do agree that the States' defense is stacked. They got some really good defensemen, like Slavin. They got Charlie McAvoy, too, I'm a big fan of. I know Sam's a big fan of as well. But I like the take, though. I like the devil's advocate with the States. I think it's going to be close. We'll see what happens.
I think it's so easy to just be so gung-ho on Canada. I mean, I do it all the time with the World Juniors. I'm like, there's no way a team's going to touch Canada in the World Juniors. And then they'll go and lose to, like, Czechia. And I think that, I don't know, I just don't love Canada's roster building on this team. I love the first two lines on forwards, but the third and fourth lines, that bottom six, I don't think they keep up with any other bottom six in the tournament. I don't think they keep up with Sweden, Finland, or the States.
I mean, a lot of it has to do, though, is like each player fills a role, right?
I know what you mean.
Bouchard, for example. Bouchard's really good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who is his role in the team? Makar. Like, so Bouchard's useless, so that's why he's not on the team, right? So it's not just best players overall. It's more like the best pieces for the whole team.
Well, I don't know how the heck Parayko made that team.
That's what I'm looking at, too. I'm like, how did Parayko make the team?
I'm happy to do this. Canada's defense is so bad. Like, terrible. They made some colossal errors.
I don't think it's bad.
I think it's bad. I'm just telling you right now, Canada's biggest issue is going to be their defensemen, not even their goaltending.
Oh, I think it's their goaltending. They play three games, and like this is not a long tournament.
No,
three games, and then like you have to finish in the top two to make the gold medal game. Like, I'm not confident in Canada's goalies to do that.
Defense to like stop the play before it even gets there.
Yeah, I don't know. I know a lot of people love Canada's team. I'm just not a huge fan.
I'll just say this, though. The U.S. probably has the best defensive lineup in the tournament by far.
Like, I would say so.
Who's the number one guy? Is it Charlie McAvoy? Is it Quinn Hughes? Is it Adam Fox?
I mean, you could Like, you can see Slavin is honestly up there.
All three of those guys are interchangeable, though. Who's the best of those three? I can't even tell you. They're all just that good. Kale McCarr's the best defenseman in the tournament.
And Zakarinski's debatably been the best D-man in the league points-wise. He's good defensively as well this season. They debatably have, like, almost all their guys other than Hanifin and Faber, like, top 10 defensemen in the league.
Yeah.
I'm just so excited to see some crazy, like, tic-tac-toe plays with McCarr, McKinnon, and McDavid. I just think it's going to be so fun to watch. But it's just going to be interesting to see how it all plays out, honestly.
Yeah.
Well, let's not forget that the U.S. has two severe cancers on their team, the Kachuk brothers. Those guys are liabilities.
Okay, but it's three games.
There's a lot of damage a baby can do when he's having a temper tantrum. When you square the babies, you're not even multiplying by two, but square them, you got a serious problem.
Are they on the same line?
Well, let's hope not. For their sake, or else they're going to be spending the whole game in the penalty box.
I don't know. I think Canada's biggest thing is Sam Reinhart. I think Sam Reinhart is totally slept on in this one. I think he's better than Matthews, to be completely honest. So I don't know. Him being on the second line too. That's pretty stacked. I think if he's producing. That might be lights out, but if Canada shows up and our goaltending just hits the fan, I think that's how we lose. Like if you show up to the first game and then like Aiden Hill's just fucking like revolving door, we're gonna have a bit of a problem.
I can see Canada coming out hot, winning the first game, but a high scoring game and not like a blowout. Like the goaltending is going to not go well. I can see like a 6-5, 7-5 win against whoever they play, and then I feel like. They completely drop off because that top six are gassed from playing that game. And then you go down to the second and third games, and I don't think the goaltending's strong enough because you don't trust your goaltending. Now your forwards are tired. And that's even if you get to the final game. I don't know. I don't love it.
I think if we play Finland, it's going to be a blowout.
Yeah. Except Patrick Laine.
I don't think there's
Patrick
a chance.
We just talk. You just talk about how no one in Canada can carry the team on their back, and then you're like, "Oh, Patrick Laine." No, it's a joke.
No, and there's plenty of players that can carry Canada. It's just, I feel like everyone has like different expectations of who that player is going to be, so they're all going to try to do too much.
Yeah, well, I can tell you this much. I don't think anyone thinks Sidney Crosby is going to be that guy. As much as I love the guy, I'm actually kind of surprised they put him on the second line. I thought he was going to be more of a third line guy this time around.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Watch him score the tournament winner.
He is not falling off at all, though. He had like 40 goals last season. Yeah.
No, but he just had a rough start. This is Sidney Crosby's first season where he's in minuses.
Minuses, yeah, but he's still a point a game.
Yeah, he's pretty close to it.
Yeah, but, I don't know. But, I don't think he's off pace. I think it's just because Pittsburgh sucks.
Yeah, you know who's better? Alex Ovechkin.
Ovi's doing better.
If Russia had a team, Ovechkin would be on the first line.
You cannot tell me.
Though. Yeah, he probably actually would be on the first line. I don't know who the center would be.
100%. He'll always be the first line until he's 50. Yeah. If they keep putting him in that back to tank.
I don't think Russia's that deep anymore, though.
Well, it's because they've been kicked out of all international play. We don't actually know how good Russia is.
Well, I mean, they have players in the NHL.
I just mean that a lot of their, because their World Juniors team haven't gotten to play in the World Juniors tournaments for the last few years, like a lot of those guys are staying in the K and aren't coming over to the NHL. So, I mean, Russia would have great goaltending. Shesterkin, there's got to be, Georgiev.
Yeah, usually what they've been doing is just like an undeclared team, they're just like in the Olympics and stuff. It's just like...
Yeah.
But Adam's right, though. Like, we don't even know what their prospects look like.
Yeah, I honestly don't. Used to be able to see their prospects.
But how have they even done in the World Juniors previous to this war with Ukraine?
Pretty good.
Yeah, like,
when was the last time they won? I can't remember anymore. Was that 2008?
I think when they beat Canada the one year.
Was that 2008?
I think it was more like 2012.
Oh.
2013. I don't remember the exact date.
All I can remember is, no, it wasn't that long ago. Did they lose to, it was like Finland or something in the bronze medal game?
Canada lost to Finland.
Russia lost to Finland.
I actually felt so bad for them because all the players literally just fell to the ice and were like sobbing.
Yeah.
Because they were like definitely going to get like absolutely reamed on when they came home.
Siberia.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you don't get that kind of emotion from losing a game normally. Like the entire bench just like fell to the ice. Sobbing.
On the topic of goaltending for Canada, though, I will just say one thing. You might all remember this. In 2010, the Olympics, Canada had a huge goaltending issue. We didn't know who the starter was going to be. Luongo started the tournament, played terrible. He got swapped out. Then he was filled in with I forget who. And then Luongo came back. And Luongo just started standing on his head. and we won the Olympics.
Okay, but having the issue between if it's Luongo or Brodeur and Aiden Hill and Jordan Binnington,
but
I would rather have the Luongo.
To Brodeur. Be fair, Binnington and Aiden Hill both were starting goalies and won cups in the last 6 years. They're definitely not as good of goalies like currently, but I feel like that is like a notable track record to bring up in this conversation. Like both having starting positions and winning cups in the last 6 years isn't bad.
Yeah. Also, the third goalie was Fleury. in 2010.
That is a hilarious.
It's an interesting thing to bring up because that is like just shows that Canada is like they can't make a decision of who's number one. No. But I think if either of those three were like the only goalie on this Canada team, it would be like a no doubter. If you're prime Brodeur or prime.
Oh. But they weren't prime at that point.
I don't think Brodeur was prime.
I think Brodeur was on the decline. I think Luongo was starting to get on the decline in 2010.
Brodeur was on the cover of NHL 14. That's 4 years after the Olympics.
Oh, yeah.
Brodeur was still good. Yeah.
You know, you got a good point.
And Luongo had just. Well, Luongo went on to the Cup final the next year.
Yeah, he did.
Fleury had won cups with Pittsburgh like 2 years before.
So maybe because they had to rise to the occasion, they became good.
Yeah. No, I actually, that.
You know what? The thing is, I just can't remember because I wasn't paying close enough attention to the NHL when I was 6 and 7.
No.
That is a ridiculously stacked lineup compared to what we have right
but
now.
But that's crazy to go from those Canadian goalies to like no good Canadian goalies.
It's kind of scary, isn't it? Like, what's the future of goaltending in Canada? Is it Devon Levi?
You know who's to blame? The government of Canada. Because they made hockey so expensive.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Hockey Canada made it.
Well, you know, expensive. I don't want to say cliche, but I mean, the carbon tax. No, I'm kidding. Sorry.
how heavy is your equipment, man? Holy.
Yeah, I'm just saying.
It's got like a four-ton truck pulling stuff.
I used to fill up the car with gas once, and now when I drive back home because of the extra sweat, the extra fabrics we have to use because we have to source stuff nationally.
I didn't think about it.
I got to fill up the car with gas 3 times now every time I drive home.
Just to be a goalie.
I
remember seeing something that a goalie mask has to be custom made, right? If you're getting like if you're playing on like an OHL team or something, like,
they pretty much all are. I don't think they buy.
Oh yeah, and even like lower level hockey, like a
you pretty know, much do actually. I've never seen a goalie who doesn't have a custom mask.
Well, because it needs to fit your head properly, right? Like if it's you can't just get like a general size one that easily. But anyways, it's like legit like $5,000 or something for one of these helmets. Who is paying that much for just one piece of equipment that you're going to have to change out every couple of years? Absolutely ridiculous. And then the pads, everything. I mean, and you also can't really get used equipment that easily, too, for goaltenders. So I'm not that surprised. Canada's had a huge problem with people's hockey signups, I think, across the country in general. And I can assume goaltending is along with that.
Yeah. I also think a lot of our good players got drafted to NHL teams and stayed there, and then their kids became American.
Hmm.
Yeah, so that's a big thing too, but I don't know if that's actually a really valid point to make.
I think it's mostly just money. It's got most of the things to do with money. I mean,
do you think all these kids of these great NHL players are actually going to turn out good, or do you think they're just there because their name?
I think it depends. It totally depends. Think of Bobby and Brett Hull. That's an exception, sure.
Yeah,
that's an exception.
It's a good exception too.
Yeah, but there's a lot of other guys I know. Like Daniel Alfredson's a brilliant example. Like his son Hugo's one of our good buddies. Hugo didn't really want to go be a professional hockey player, so he didn't. But Alfredson has a younger son named Phoenix who probably will play in the NHL and be pretty good. Like, he's ranked top 3 in the province, his kid's his age.
Yeah.
So I think it just depends on the individual. Although,
I just think of that fellow over in Ottawa system, Tyler Boucher, is it? Hmm. Wasn't he like a really high draft pick? And he's son of Brian Boucher, right?
Yeah, he was 10th overall to Ottawa, for sure. Yeah.
I don't know. He's having a really bad year this year. Have you guys seen his minor league stats? He's got no points in 14 games.
I wasn't paying attention, but I did see that he played 20 games in the NCAA before he came to play with the 67s.
Oh,
and he had 2 points and was -5 in those 20 NCAA games. And then the OHL, he was less than a point a game.
Yeah. Well, speaking of this, like Ottawa and the Senators, Ottawa has a total of 0 prospects in the World Juniors coming up. That is ridiculous. I can't believe like there's no one.
Oh, I don't even know Montreal. I don't think Montreal has any prospects.
Montreal's a few.
Well, Montreal's got a couple. Ottawa has like actually 0 though. I don't think I've ever heard of that for an NHL team to just have no prospects in the World Juniors. But
a lot of people say is it Yakmachuk? People were saying that he should have been on it. Their most recent draft pick, first rounder.
Yeah. James, I don't think he's in.
What about Vancouver? Do they have any prospects? and playing this, you know?
I'm not too sure about the prospects. They did get a W on Friday night, though. Me and Sam were watching the game. Oh, yeah. We didn't end up finishing it, but it was 2-1. And Columbus was absolutely peppering Vancouver, and then they got some momentum getting a goal late in the second. And Sam made the prediction that they were going to get the W because they had the momentum, and I agreed. And I ended up watching a little bit of the game when I was supposed to be studying, and they ended up winning 5-2. It was absolutely sick. So that was nice to get the W. I think Vancouver's kind of turning it around a little bit. On the topic of Canadian teams, I personally think that Edmonton is going to hopefully replicate, but finish it in game 7 this year against the Florida Panthers. That's my prediction to win the cup is the Edmonton Oilers. I think Connor McDavid has an absolute fire in his belly, and I think he's going to carry that team as well as Leon with his new contract, 14.5. So I was just wondering what your guys' opinion on is, who you think the favorite of Canadian teams to win, and what you think about Edmonton getting the hoisting the Stanley Cup.
I mean, I think Edmonton, honestly, I had super high hopes for Jeff Skinner and Victor Arvidsson. I'm not going to say that they've been like total bombs in terms of production, but Skinner hasn't been great. Arvidsson's out right now. A little bit underwhelming on that side. I think they're going to step it up, though. I think the issue, though, is that they don't have the same speed as last year. They had a lot of speed. Warren Fogle, Holloway, like Broberg. I mean, they were a bunch of like pretty fast players. So I think they need to do some switching around at the trade deadline to be back to where they were last year. I think they will, for sure. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think they're kind of in a tough spot, though, now, because they've got to either go for some more speed, which is debatable. That might be one of the most top priorities, or change out some D-men, which is also pretty high up there. I think they're probably going to go for the defense switch, maybe get one defenseman and then maybe one faster forward. If they can do that, they're looking pretty solid, I would say.
Do you think Edmonton has the best shot, or are you putting Winnipeg for a better shot at the Cup?
I don't actually. I have pretty low faith in Winnipeg, because I said last year their first round performance was pretty abysmal. So based on that, I don't know. I'll believe it when I see it, kind of in terms of their performance in the playoffs, because they just couldn't. Playoffs come down to literally special teams is everything. If you can't score in the power play and can't like shut down on the PK, you're just going to lose every time. Like that was the story for the entire playoffs last year, was if you had good special teams, you went far. That's why Edmonton went far. They had a ridiculously good penalty kill, and their power play was producing, so that's why they won. They didn't win because they're 5-on-5.
I don't like any of the Canadian teams. I think they're a curse. I just can't see it happening. I think out of all of them, Edmonton would probably be the team that I can see most likely doing it, since they went there and were one game away from winning. So,
is the parade still on for the Leafs? I'm just checking.
No.
I think it's probably canceled.
I don't know. I think Calgary's got a better chance than the Leafs. Calgary's been off to a great start.
I think based off the way Calgary's team was looking at the start of the season, that's almost a bit surprising.
I just can't see Toronto winning a cup in my lifetime. I don't know. Especially not in my lifetime, but with this team, I don't think with this team.
Toronto's got some. They have some elite potential to make some huge moves though this season. They might be moving Marner at the trade deadline.
Wait, they should. Oh, really?
So that could be Mitch Marner? Huge.
I'd take Mitch Marner. I just don't actually think there's any chance he'd actually end up in Ottawa.
Honestly, I think that's the last.
Get rid of Brady Tkachuk, send him down to the minors and put Marner.
The last thing Ottawa needs.
Give him the C.
Marner is not someone that shows up and like stabilizes a team. If anything, he's like not a very mature player. So I don't know if that's what Ottawa needs. But yeah. I mean, we'd take him. I think anyone would, but. Yeah,
What do you think, Sam Oilers, for the Cup?
Okay, here's what I'll say. If Edmonton makes the Stanley Cup Finals, they'll win the Stanley Cup, because in the last 4 Stanley Cups, every team that's won made it to the Stanley Cup Finals the year before and lost, and they made it back again and they won. So if Edmonton makes it to the Finals, they'll win.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Winnipeg has a good chance, but they do have some structural issues. Vancouver could too, but I don't think Ottawa, Montreal, or Toronto have a great shot. I don't think Calgary has a great chance either. They have a chance, but I just don't think it's substantial.
Are we really lumping Toronto in with Ottawa and Montreal?
Yeah.
I don't
I think Toronto's not that bad.
I feel like Toronto should get more respect.
Maybe they should. But my only point is, I just like
the playoff performance has been rough.
Yeah.
Look, I was grouping teams together who I thought had no prospect of winning. I think Toronto has no prospect of winning.
That's
because it's Toronto. If Toronto's team plays great, their fans will tear them to shreds. If they play terrible, their team will light them up. So it's just, it is the way it is.
Yeah. No, I kind of agree. I mean, Stolarz has been really good, so their goaltending's been solid at least. So, but yeah, I don't predict them going too far. Another first round, maybe second round.
I can see them losing the second round, I think.
Yeah, maybe.
they're not gonna win though.
No.
All right, and we'll leave you with that. Thank you again for tuning in to Plugged In My Ears, and we'll be back with you next week.
With the colder months coming up, we're all using more natural gas in our homes. While it's a reliable and safe energy source, it's super important to keep safety in mind. If you smell something weird, like rotten eggs, it might mean that there's a gas leak. Act fast. Leave the area and call your natural gas provider. Also, don't forget about carbon monoxide.